I'm Amy Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we're Building Bridges.
Fight Like Hell, the history of American laborers uprising and workers today taking up the challenge.
Fighting like hell for labor change.
Kim Kelly, author of Fight Like Hell, the Untold History of American Labor, and Hamilton Nolan, labor journalist and author of the soon-to-be-released The Year of the Hammer, look at how the labor movement can be the tool that fixes America if it chooses to rise to the challenge.
They unearth the stories of the people, farm laborers, domestic workers, factory employees behind some of the labor movement's biggest successes, and how they spark workers today to rise up against capital with a new militancy for power to the working class. Let's listen to Kim Kelly and Hamilton Nolan, recorded at the famed Tamamith Library.
I wanted to ask you to share with us one of your favorite labor stories from your book.
One of the ones I always love to bring up is this strike that happened in Hawaii, 1946, the Great Sugar Strike, a time when the island's economy was predominantly based around agriculture and sugarcane plantations that were owned by white European men who lived on the mainland and worked by a variety of workers from Asian countries, Native Hawaiians, Puerto Rican workers, black workers from the mainland, ethnicities and races and cultures. And they're organized under the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. The bosses would use the fact that it was a very diverse workforce to separate them. In earlier moments, bosses would bring in Filipino workers to break Japanese workers' strikes, Korean workers to break Japanese workers-led strikes. They tried to keep people apart so they couldn't connect even if they wanted to. In 1946, another big strike was looming. The union was like, well, we can't let them do this to us again. They did, but so effective. They pulled people together, they brought in translators, they brought in community leaders, and made sure in every meeting people were understood, they felt heard, built a real sense of solidarity because they were finally seeing each other as allies instead of competition. They built strike kitchens where different types of workers cooked for one another and built community that way. They made it very clear that everyone was in this together. Allowing the bosses to pull them apart would make all of them suffer. And they won big. The biggest raise they've seen in 20 years. They do not mess around in Hawaii when it comes to unions. Thinking about that story of these multiracial, multigender, multi-ethnic, multilingual workers coming together and taking on the Jeff Bezoses, the sugarcane world, and winning. The kind of story that translates directly into wins that we've seen today, like at the Amazon Labor Union, the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, where workers made sure that they're understood, multiple languages, multiple cultures. People cooked for each other and shared barbecue and jollof rice in the parking lot. This kind of lesson that is so basic, but sometimes has gotten forgotten throughout labor history, where we are so much stronger together and our differences can be our strengths. And as long as we hold on to that, winning is inevitable.
It was inspiring.
I try, you know. I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna about these things. We're a foil for one another.
You grew up in the woods in Jersey. The two of us is probably about 10% of the working labor journalists in America right here. Like, tell us, like, how did you get into this? What was your sort of doorway into the world of labor?
I grew up in the woods, specifically in the Pine Barrens, which this working class, blue-collar village. My family are all union construction workers and steel workers and teachers. I always knew growing up that unions were a good thing and that they helped us, and that's why we were able to pay for groceries, and that's also why Dad had to go on strike sometimes or had to go to meetings. But I always wanted to be a writer, and I also spent most of my life in the music business working in the heavy metal world. So even having that background, I never thought that unions were something that would factor into my own life. Turns out I was wrong, because when I started working at Vice, they used to have a music vertical called Noisy, and I was the heavy metal editor. Finally got hired full time. 2 weeks later, a couple coworkers pulled me aside and said, "Hey, we're thinking about unionizing." I was like, oh, thank God. It's probably still not a great place to work, but it was a hell of a lot worse in 2014. And I got super involved. I was in every meeting, every committee, every bargaining session. But I told someone the other day that labor became my new favorite band, because I was spending so much more time at union halls and union meetings than I was at heavy metal shows. And I was like happy about it. I was like, this is really cool. And I knew about the history and the context now. But I started pitching stories about labor and workers' rights, and I eventually started writing some things like that for Teen Vogue. That was very unique at the time, that we were seeing that kind of writing and that kind of like labor-focused content on a website like Teen Vogue. And it made me think, okay, if I can keep pitching stories like this and keep getting positive attention, keep getting this out there, maybe I could actually do this. Maybe I can be a labor reporter. And by the time I got laid off in 2019, I was like, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. Give it a shot. See how it goes. About a year later, I signed the contract for this book, Typical Heavy Metal to Labor Pipeline.
That's right. You've written this book about labor history and labor journalists, and as we both know, like, it's one thing to write about labor and interview all these inspiring union people, and then there's also your own union, right? And we're both in the Writers Guild East, and I'm interested in how writing this book and learning all of inspiring stories of labor's radical history have informed what you do as a union member and as a elected representative in our union.
Because it's something we've experienced in our own union that I've seen like through my research and just throughout talking to people in other unions that I think is so common, is that there's the old guard and then there's the new guard. There's people that are younger, who are newer, who have a lot of energy and new ideas, that they become organized, they get involved, they want to change everything. And the folks who used to be them, who have now ended up in a position where they're kind of part of the institution, they have a lot of knowledge, they have a lot of skills, a lot to offer, but they're a little less willing to listen to these new kids because they're new kids. What do they know? It's something that unions have been dealing with for, and it kind of comes down to how unions and union leaderships, the union leadership decides to navigate that. Sometimes it gets very acrimonious. And sometimes reform slaves happen, and sometimes that's a good thing. Look at the Teamsters with the Teamsters for a Democratic Union movement. Look at the UAW with the One Member, One Vote campaign. Like, there's such a hunger, I think, for more democracy and more radicalism and more militancy in the labor movement. Some union leadership is a little uncomfortable with that, but there's more of us than there are of them, ultimately. Like, the rank and file should kind of dictate what happens, right? It kind of makes you think of this story from the 30s and 40s, this one specific union on the waterfront, San Francisco, the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which was very radical, very gay, predominantly black and Asian, real red, like socialist communist union. It's one of my favorite sections of the book. It started out being like racist and exclusionary. All the leadership were white. They were not reflective of the membership and of the times and of the needs of their union. And so what the union leadership did one day, they looked around and were like, oh, we're not doing our jobs right. And they all resigned. And then they brought in, like, the next round of leaders, like, were black and brown rank and file types. They were real red. They were much more representative of the union. Until they got crushed in the, you know, in the Red Scare, like happened to a lot of cool unions. They were really powerful and really inclusive and just did a great job. And I like thinking about that as an example of what can happen when people listen to one another.
So let's talk about where the labor movement is today. I mean, your book is about the radical elements of the labor movement throughout history, and today, obviously, that same kind of struggle and tension remains in the labor movement today. I mean, we both went to the AFL-CIO convention, which was in Philly, and right after that, we went to Labor Notes, which is like, you know, the AFL-CIO is like the institutional part of labor, and then Labor Notes is like the activist part of labor. And you could see the difference when you think of all the things going on in the labor movement today. How radical does it need to be?
I think it needs to be very radical. That's the book. And I made a point of writing about more progressive, more radical, more militant figures and moments, because that's a big part of our history, that if you only went to AFL-CIO convention or only talked to union presidents or only talked to people who were super cozy with, you know, Democratic lobbyists and whatnot, you wouldn't hear about that part of it. You would think, oh, like, the labor movement is just like a Democrat thing. It always has been. That is not the case. If you're a worker in this country, like, you are probably impacted by issues that are not just bread and butter, whether it's racism or transphobia, misogyny, ableism, xenophobia, all of the different ways that you can be ground down by the people who run our lives. Like, those are all labor issues too. Abortion rights are a labor issue. Trans rights are a labor issue. So of course I want us to get more radical. Of course I want to see, you know, 1,000 new Starbucks organizing waves bloom, wherever it is, whatever industry it is. And I really hope that our leaders and that folks who have been around for a long time, who know a lot and have a lot to share with the movement, are watching movements like Amazon or Starbucks or REI or Star Garden Strippers at the Topless Bar in North Hollywood and seeing the way that they center racial justice and queer and trans rights and all of these political identities and aspects of existence that, of course, are part of the working class existence in America, but perhaps are seen by some to be too controversial, too political, too something. Maybe they'll scare off our membership. Well, who do you think your members are? And if it's not them, I just think that it would be good if people pay a little bit more attention to what regular working people are dealing with and stopped acting as though the avatar of, like, the white guy in a hard hat is the end-all, be-all of labor. Like,
I mean, I was having a conversation the other day with somebody about 2020 and the protests and the visibility that the racial justice issues got in that time and how absent labor was in that conversation to a certain extent. Like, you wrote about a lot of aspects of this in your book. I mean, how do you think about racial justice in the labor movement, how those issues go together?
Well, it's always been part of it, right? But it's also been inconvenient for some people who think that unions should care about one type of person or one industry or one guild or one craft or whatever. I mean, I think back to the early 1900s, like 1910, Ben Fletcher was a black man who was born in the neighborhood, a dock worker, and he's also a socialist, and he's also part of the IWW. He organized an incredibly strong, militant, multiracial union on the waterfront that was made up of black workers, Eastern European and Irish white workers. They were a firmly anti-racist, anti-capitalist union, and they dominated the docks for 10 years. Then the Sedition Act passed, World War II happened, a bunch of people got thrown in jail. The government basically was like, oh no, we're not doing all that. But they did it for a time. Ben Fletcher was talking about racial capitalism before a lot of people would have even known what that meant. Examples like that are so important to remember because it's not as if racial justice as an issue or racism as an issue sprang fully formed from the headlines in 2020. But it's been part of this movement the whole time, for better and for worse. The U.S. labor movement has such a long history of xenophobia and racism and exclusion, too. That is also not the kind of thing that you might find in an AFL-CIO press release, but it's very much something that has happened. In the book, I don't pull that many punches about things like how black workers were excluded from all the major unions for a very, very, very long time, or how, you know, the AFL president was a big fan of the Chinese Exclusion Act, or refused to organize Latino workers in the Southwest for a very long time. Like, we're doing a little bit better now, but if we don't acknowledge how bad it was and the part we played in it, it's not going to get to where it needs to be anytime soon.
It's always like this stumbling block, especially during the George Floyd protests for the AFL-CIO and the institutions of the labor movement, where people were kind of saying, which side are you on? Talk a little bit about how you see police unions as part of the labor movement or not.
Well, they're not. Throughout history, the police have protected capital and property in the interests of the rich. They have never been on our side, from when they were formed as slave patrols to subjugate other human beings, to the mine guards during the mine wars that gunned down striking coal miners, to right now when working class black and brown and indigenous people are gunned down in the street with impunity. Like, and I've had a lot of conversations with people in the movement about this, about how, oh, well, not all police are like that. Some, like, police do count as workers. They have, there's police in other unions, like AFSCME, the Teamsters. And, okay, that is a conversation that we can continue to have, but they've never been on our side, right? A steel worker or a Starbucks worker cannot murder somebody in the street and know that their union is going to protect them and make sure they don't see any consequences. That alone is disqualifying, without getting into the long history of strike breaking and blackguarding and murder and the Pinkertons and all of the things we've seen. Actually, Richard Trumka, the late head of the AFL-CIO, years ago, I think he was right when he was talking about seeing our brothers shooting down our other brothers and sisters, right? Like, that's not something that should be allowed to stand, and I think we need to have a much larger, more frank conversation about it in the movement, and I would like to see less knee-jerk reactions from people that don't see it that way, because honestly, like, what is it going to take for that people who oppose those ideas to wake up and think, oh, okay, something here isn't quite right. let them have their own thing, but I don't think they should be able to sit with us.
Yeah. We did not win that argument, by the way, with the AFL-CIO.
They did not respond
to us. Trash. I thought it was cool that you had a section in your book about organizing prison.
It was really important to me to make sure that I had a chapter on incarcerated workers, on workers in prison, because I was writing a labor book about marginalized workers. And one could argue that incarcerated workers are the prime example of that, because they are people that have jobs, they go to work, some of them get paid a little itty-bitty bit. They do not have the same rights as other workers outside the walls, not only because of where they're at and the conditions they live under, but typically there's this one Supreme Court decision that came about in the late 70s, which is during a time, an explosive moment of organizing for prisoners' rights, for the prisoners' labor union movement had really taken off. And this was also kind of in conjunction with the Black Power movement, the Chicana Power movement. Like, there was a lot happening in that space. At a time, there were prisoners' labor unions in different facilities across the country. And some of them were developed to the point where, like, they had affiliated with outside labor organizations. In 1977, the Jones versus North Carolina Prisoners Labor Union case, Supreme Court ruled that incarcerated workers do not have a right to organize, dashed cold water all over that movement, made it so much harder to organize. That doesn't mean that people stopped, especially post-2014 when IWOC, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, was formed by incarcerated and formerly incarcerated workers. They've been a big driving force behind more recent prison strikes that we've seen in, like, 2018, 2019, 2020, in conjunction with organizations like Jailhouse Leaders Speak and the Free Alabama Movement. A couple weeks ago, we saw a massive prison strike of people incarcerated in Alabama's prisons. And there's a lot of different ways to protest inside, because you can't picket at your prison job. You don't have the rights that people outside do. Well, I would have loved to see the AFL-CIO supporting the Alabama prison strike, but we didn't. But we did.
Another thing that I believe is in the book and still ongoing to this day is the Warrior Met strike. Warrior Met is the longest real strike continuing in America. Where's that at right now? How's it going? And what is the resolution of that going to be?
It's happening in Brookwood, Alabama, Tuscaloosa County, about 45 minutes outside of Birmingham. Over 1,000 coal miners who are part of the UMWA, United Mine Workers of America, they've been on strike since April 1st, 2020. It's an unfair labor practices strike, essentially, because the company is refusing to bargain in good faith and really give them anything to work with. They're trying to give them a terrible contract. And Warrior Met, this Wall Street-backed venture capital flush company, had come in to a bunch of their investors, and they came into rural Alabama and they bought up this bankrupt mine, formerly Jim Walter Resources. They rehired most of the people who'd been laid off during that bankruptcy and said, okay, we're going to give you a terrible contract that cuts your pay by $6 an hour and cuts your personal days, and you can sign that, and then in 5 years we're back on our feet. We'll take care of you. We'll be good. Folks do what they got to do to take care of their families. They signed on the dotted line, went to work, treated like garbage for years, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, 2,000 feet underground in a methane-filled coal mine, the deepest in North America, for $27 an hour, and then came time to negotiate a contract. And the company handed them basically the same thing they'd had before with a couple little tweaks. So they went on strike, and they've been on strike ever since. We've come really close to the people involved, especially the women. The women's auxiliaries really kept it going. And there's this really long tradition of coal miners' wives and spouses and family members keeping strikes alive. Some of those women who helped out with that effort are now helping out with this effort. All that to say, these folks have been ignored because they're in blood red, deep south Alabama. They're coal miners, complicated profession. A lot of them are conservative. They're a lot of religious people, not necessarily the progressive image that a lot of people have of union members. So they've kind of been on their own, except for the support from the labor community and from local socialist groups like the DSA, which has actually led some of the folks involved to change their politics, which is really interesting to see. And I'm not sure what it's going to take. I think it's going to have to get even uglier. I think if Marty Walsh was, he would have his ass down there and try to help negotiate, intervene, and help. Honestly, and this is, like, pretty gnarly.
Because the mine is still operating scabs.
Oh, yeah. like, not only is it operating, like, scabs have been attacking miners on the picket lines, and there's video evidence of people running trucks into strikers. The cops do not care. They drive the other way. It's a really volatile situation.
It is crazy to me that Joe Biden is not in Brookwood, Alabama, making a campaign ad with a bunch of freaking Alabama coal miners who've been on strike. I mean, what, like, are the Democrats? I don't know. I can't explain it. Who do you find to be inspirational in the labor movement today? Like, who are the people or the groups in labor today that you think are doing the right thing?
Oh, wow. I think Stacey Davis Gates from the Chicago Teachers Union is, like, one of the coolest and best, most militant leaders we have. Have to shout out Sarah Nelson, the president of the Flight Attendants Union, because she is, like, she's the real deal. She's actually one of the only, her and Mark Perrone, actually, I gotta shout him out, are some of the only big union leaders who have paid any attention to the strike, too. She's been down there a bunch, and they love her, because she can drink them under the table. Those are some of my favorite leaders, I guess. But just, it sounds a little hokey, but it's always just the workers and the organizers, the people who are doing it. Whether it's like 20-something-year-old Starbucks baristas or someone like Isaiah Thomas, who is a 21-year-old young man in Birmingham, who's keeping the Amazon organizing effort alive in Bessemer while going to school for criminal justice. Like, the young people that are doing this, it's just so cool and so inspiring, and I'm so proud of them, because when I was 20, I was not trying to change the world. I was drinking 40s in West Philly and going to punk shows. So, God, the youth, but, like, they know so much more than I did at that age, and they are willing to do so much more than I would have been willing to do at that age. It's just, it's got to be invigorating, right? That are unionizing their workplaces.
That's true. No, all the most inspiring stories always the workers that you meet.
Yeah, that's why we do this stuff.
That's right. Including the New School on strike. Yeah. And HarperCollins right down Broadway is on strike right now.
Yeah.
Another picket line
walking
for y'all to
distance.
Go to.
I just read an article about this for Insider, something where I talked to a bunch of young people about, you know, why is your generation so active? What's driving you? What's going on? And actually, Isaiah, the young man I mentioned, who's 21, he's telling me how he remembers seeing his millennial parents, which, struggling during the economic downturn. They had to take on extra shifts. He never saw them. And he remembered thinking, I don't want my life to be like this. And these younger kids, they have access to so much more information so much quicker than people that didn't grow up in such a hyper-connected world did. This is like kind of the post-Occupy, post-Bernie 2016, 99%. Like, watching the rise of Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and just the incredible amount of inequality and just economic awfulness that these kids have been born into and are entering the labor market into. On top of the ravages of COVID, kids who maybe started their first job in the midst of a global pandemic. Like, there's so many different factors that are pushing these younger people towards organizing, towards collective action, because I think there's a real loss of faith in elected officials and in electoral politics, because, I mean, have you seen the state of things? So I just think it's really inspiring and really great for the movement. And also, one last thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people I wrote about in my book, a lot of the people we know about through history, they were young too. You know, during the civil rights movement, like MLK and the guys from SNCC, like, they were in their early 20s. Like, this isn't really a new thing either. I think it's just more visible because now they're all on TikTok dragging Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. Surveys today show that unions are more popular with young, more popular in general than they've been in multiple generations, but extremely popular with young people, and get more popular the younger people go. And a lot of the most, Starbucks union in particular, but a lot of the sort of retail store unions, Apple Store and REI, and a lot of those are tons of young people driving those unions today.
I would love to see them use whatever lobbying, electoral, political power they have to fix our busted labor laws that exclude people and have always excluded people, and, you know, do something to stop the spread of right to work, do something about the minimum wage. Like, these are these kind of big picture things that would make everyone's lives better, and it, of course, impact the movement. But also, I just want to see them pour money and time and effort and resources into organizing. because if we're going to make up for all the losses, I mean, as much as it's an exciting time, the numbers are not good. We're at, like, what, 10% union density? That's terrible. We can do something about it. I think we just need more will from the people who have those resources to go out and organize everyone they can get their hands on, because that just brings in more people, more power, more dues money that they can give to their friends in Washington to maybe get some cool stuff passed. I mean, that's, what do you think? You cover stuff like this too.
Yeah. Read my book in 2024. No, I mean, yeah, basically, like, you know, the labor movement will talk about how bad labor laws are and how that stops us from organizing, which is true. But also, we haven't been able to change those laws for like 60, 70, 80 years. So at a certain point, you have to organize in the environment you have, and they are not spending the resources. There's just not the resources dedicated to organizing that there needs to be. So we actually have much more demand among working people who wish they had a union than there are union organizers to organize them. And that's a failure of the union establishment, basically.
That's where we're seeing these independent unions, like Amazon Labor Union, that's a big one, but there's also workers at Home Depot and Chipotle, probably like, I think there's like 12 or so active right now. There's a bunch.
Trader Joe's.
Yeah, right? And that says something. Like, if the current institutions and structures aren't serving the people that want to organize, and if the IWW isn't the path they want to take, then they're going to have to do it themselves. And imagine how much easier and more effective it would be if we could take all that money that they have from our dues and help people organize unions. Because that's what we want. That's what we need. And yeah, the AFL-CIO's stated goal for the next 10 years or so, right, is 10 years? A million people.
A million new union members in 10 years was the stated goal of the AFL-CIO. And if you do the math, that would actually make union density go down. Because there's going to be way more workers 10 years from now. So that's an idea of the problem. That goes to show that is the thing to break that political impasse that we have right now. You know, it feels like everybody's like, America's so stuck in red and blue, and like, how are we ever going to get out of this? And the answer is the labor movement. That's where those people come together with the common cause. And from that, you can build. So we have a broken labor movement today. We have low union density, especially in red states. You have union density that's 5% or less. Like, that's not changing the world. But by reviving the labor movement, man, that's like the crowbar that's gonna get in there and, I think, break that political impasse that people don't know how to break.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's one of the very few almost universal experiences of this country, right? Almost everybody has a job or did have a job or is going to have a job. And they're probably going to hate it a little bit. And their boss is definitely going to take advantage of them. And right there, you can build a whole lot on the sentiment of take this job and shove it.
That's right.
So on a very, very positive note.
Thank you.
We're building bridges. You've been listening to a discussion from the Labor Library Tenement with Kim Kelly, author of Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, and Hamilton Nolan, labor journalist, author of the soon-to-be-released The Year of the Hammer. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Educate, agitate, and organize for another world as possible.